Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, they never go home, they never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
You can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I'd like to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to need it there.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down to Anfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawnee man?
It's December 27th, a time when many people are still taking it easy, unplugging, de-stressing, enjoying time with loved ones. But, as ever, there was a bunch of football on the 26th, and you know what that means. It's our annual Second Captain Scrooge football show with Jonathan Wilson. There was some sensational action yesterday. Arsenal won 5-0 against Norwich. Myself and Jonathan didn't talk about that. We spent nearly 40 minutes on this podcast on Thursday talking about how incredible Arsenal are. And the bad news for Arsenal supporters is that my Uncle Jerry, also an Arsenal supporter, believes that their recent good run isn't getting carried away by their recent good run. He believes it is merely an artifact of a winnable run of fixtures. So time will tell on that one. Chelsea won 3-1. We didn't talk about that either. The big Chelsea game is probably the one next Sunday, January 2nd, at Stamford Bridge against Liverpool. So I'm sure this day next week, we're going to be talking a lot of Chelsea. What did we talk about? Well, we talked about that crazy Manchester City-Leicester City game. And we also got into Jonathan's new novel, Streltsov, which I'll let him explain to you when the time comes. So I guess without further fanfare, it's time for Scrooge Football 2021 with Jonathan Wilson.
It's like something you would expect to see in a porno movie.
You go out of Temple Bar, you see them coming out of pubs, vomiting, having sex on the side of the street.
It's like something you would expect to see in a porno movie.
You know, is that the normal we want in this country? You know, we're supposed to be civilized. As far as I can see, this country is getting more barbaric.
Well, I imagine it was like something you would expect to see in a porno movie.
What would you see in a porno movie, Mary?
Jonathan Wilson, it's great to have you on the annual Scrooge show. I hope you haven't been enjoying Christmas too much.
Not too much. No, it's been all right. I haven't done a lot. I've eaten quite a bit. Haven't drunk an excessive amount. I've had quite a nice time. Caught up on MasterChef.
Oh, MasterChef, right? But MasterChef isn't about the 1917 revolution. It's not starring. I can't remember the other ingredients. What can you just fill people in if people haven't been glued to your Twitter feed over the last couple of days? You have a complicated system for deciding whether or not you can watch a film in the Christmas period.
Yeah, this began last year because I was unexpectedly stuck in London with a friend after holidays had to be cancelled. And it's the first time that I've been in London alone at Christmas because of various, families all disappeared now. So watching films becomes sort of a big part of the day to give yourself something to focus around. So I made the argument last year that Dr. Zhivago is the perfect Christmas film on the grounds it's quite long and it has snow in it.
The snow looks very fake, though, I think, in Dr. Zhivago. I've never seen snow that I've so clearly saying, well, that's fake snow.
Certainly some of it is real. It was filmed in Spain during the winter. I think the fake snow of Nicholas and Alexander, which I watched this Christmas Day, is actually faker. I think it's worse.
That film is about the last Romanovs.
Yes, exactly. Mm. It's got an amazing cast of Brian Cox is in it playing Trotsky, which is quite odd.
Very good.
Fiona Fullerton's playing Anastasia. She'd only be about 16 in it. But you know, when you suddenly see something, you think, oh, hang on, I recognise her, who's that? And yeah, finally dawned on me as Fiona Fullerton. I have no idea
who Fiona Fullerton is, but.
Oh, she's in View to a Kill.
I did see that.
She's sort of the main Bond girl in that, other than Grace Jones.
Mm. But what is the system?
So from Zhivago, decided last Christmas to only watch films either starring Alec Guinness or directed by David Lean. So we also watched Kind Hearts and Coronets with Alec Guinness, which is very, very good, actually. I was surprised by it. It's genuinely a funny comedy from, late 40s, early 50s. And we watched David Copperfield, also David Lean, and also has Alec Guinness in it. Oliver Twist I've got lined up for later this week, which is David Lean, Alec Guinness, and Dickens, as Great Expectations is. So there's these four interlocking circles, which I think is the biggest Venn diagram, most complex Venn diagram you can do in two dimensions. So it's got to be directed by David Lean, it's got a star like Guinness, it's got to be about the 1917 revolution, as Nicholas Alexander and Dr. Zhivago are, or it's got to be an adaptation of Dickens, as Oliver Twist and David Copperfield are.
Yeah, and do you know how many films you're limited to seeing now? I mean, is this one of those 6 degrees to Kevin Bacon thing, which actually includes, you know, hundreds of thousands of films?
Well, it's obviously a lot. Alec Guinness was in a lot of films. David Lean must have directed, I don't know, I'm going to guess between 15 and 20 films. You've got Bridge Over the River Kwai. That's Alec Guinness as well, isn't it? David Lean and Alec Guinness worked together a lot. Lawrence of Arabia, which I saw the remastered version when it came out, 50th anniversary. It came out, when would that have been? It's so long, there's an intermission. And Sunderland beat Reading that night, I remember, because it was 2-0 during the intermission. We won it 3-0. So it must be, I don't know, it must be 10 years ago. David Lean's just quality. You know, there's no bad David Lean film. Passage to India.
Mm. Ryan's Daughter is generally considered
Ryan's
to be
Daughter,
bad,
that's right, yeah.
Although,
is it a bad film?
Well, I mean, everyone said so at the time, but I think that was probably just anti-Irish prejudice.
Yeah. The problem is Dickens obviously didn't write about the 1917 revolution, which you can't really blame him for. But I hold out hope that there are, you know, an adaptation of Dickens set in the 1917 revolution. I mean, I think, you know, Oliver Twist could easily be transposed to St. Petersburg during the First World War.
What do you think David Lean would have made of Manchester City 6, Leicester City 3? What would he have made of the mindless sort of thrills and spills? The utter chaos, the utter bizarreness, the utter inexplicability of the 15-minute period in which Leicester City, after being comprehensively trounced off the field, just humiliated, wiped away, it was like, stop the fight. They have this 15-minute period where everything they do slices through Manchester City. They can't be stopped. They look irresistible. They look like one of the greatest teams ever to play the game. That goes on for 12, 15 minutes, and then it's back to Manchester City just scoring goals, and the match finished 6-3, which sounds 6-3. Whenever you hear a match finish 6-3, it always sounds like a really interesting match. Was this that?
Well, it wasn't, because City were 4-0 up when it became interesting. I don't think Leicester did sort of fold again, did they? Because, I mean, there's the Iheanacho chance when we would have made it 5-4. There's the Albrighton header, which would have made it 5-4. I mean, Leicester basically conceded two really soft goals from set plays, which has been a problem for them all season. And what we saw in that second half is City are still vulnerable to teams who break effectively. Now, that might be because Rodri wasn't there. And I think Rodri's been very good this season and has helped them defend against the counter. But, you know, we've seen Leicester do this to City before. I mean, near the beginning of last season, they won 5-2 at the Etihad. Pep's first season, they beat them, I want to say 4-0, but it might have been 4-1. They got those four very early goals at the King Power. So there's something about the way Leicester play clearly does rattle City. I guess the surprise is that suddenly happens when it's 4-0, and maybe that's to do with City slightly switching off and just losing a bit of defensive focus. But I think it speaks well of this Leicester side that even with all the injuries, even 4-0 down, that they are still capable of coming out in the second half and at least having a bit of pride to play for, and then actually turning it into something that might have been a bit more.
The key figure for them, I suppose, was Maddison. He did a lot in that sort of spell, including drawing a save from Ederson that was like the one that he drew from Ramsdale earlier, at the end of the saving a shot, dipping shot onto the bar. The moment when he took both Laporte and Diaz out of the game with two touches was one to remember. Where do you think he stands at the moment, Maddison? Because he's kind of been left behind a bit. I mean, I remember it's not that long since he was sort of vying with Grealish as the, who will Gareth Southgate, pick? And Grealish obviously kind of just completely strode away from him. But there in that game yesterday, Maddison was kind of the star creator in the game, and Grealish is watching in a sulk from the bench where he's been put to stew for disciplinary reasons.
I mean, I think Maddison had a slow start of the season, didn't he? But the last sort of 6 weeks or so, he's been back to his best. I guess Leicester aren't playing as well this season as they were last season, so maybe it hasn't been as obvious. Maybe it's been a bit harder.
Is he that good, though? I mean, what do you actually make of him? Clearly, he does have a lot of ability in some ways. But, like, is he a player on Grealish's level? I mean, Grealish is obviously the most expensive English player of all time, even if he's currently not in the Man City team. Is Maddison on that level? Should a bigger club than Leicester, I mean, Leicester, who obviously have won the Premier League and the FA Cup pretty recently and are one of the biggest clubs currently in English football, but should one of the more traditional, Arsenal or somebody like that, be saying, let's sign this guy?
Well, I mean, there's an implicit assumption in your question, which is that Grealish is of that level, which I have to say I've never been entirely convinced by. Plenty of forward players, especially wide forward players, have started slowly under Guardiola, and it's been the second season when they've really blossomed, and that may happen with Grealish. But I mean, I certainly wasn't one of those desperate for Grealish to be in the England team.
So you actually think that maybe Maddison is just as good as Grealish?
I think that a similar category, I mean, there's slightly different styles of player, but I think the similar category of player in that I think they're really good for those sort of upper mid-table teams, such as Villa or Leicester, who have aspirations, maybe one day to qualify for Champions League, certainly to be relatively regular Europa League participants, maybe to win a cup, where the game can sort of flow through them in a way that you can't quite do with the very best teams. So I don't know. It's difficult to know. It's possible Maddison could go to. I mean, it's also. I know Arsenal are currently having a better season than Leicester, but over the last 5 years, would you say Arsenal have stepped up on Leicester? I'm not really sure.
No, I mean, Jamie Vardy made that call. He was the guy presented with the choice, and I mean, you can't say that he has been vindicated in deciding not to join Arsenal. And was it 2017?
Yeah. And then, is the place for Maddison at, say, City or Liverpool or Chelsea? I can't really see that. So I'm not really sure which other club at the moment you could say is an obvious step up from Leicester.
I think
we're far too quick, or we're far too keen to sort of impose these narratives on players that they... they're playing well, they're comfortable, they're happy where they are, they're, I don't know, scoring a dozen goals a season, setting up another dozen, and their team's sort of, in that sort of fifth to eighth bracket, which I guess Leicester aren't at the minute, but the injuries are pretty...
You would expect them to be there, definitely.
Yeah, and even if they're not this season, I just don't think it's... When they've had the injuries they've had, I don't think it's... You can really blame them for that. Who does it really benefit if they move and end up playing sort of a dozen games a season at a bigger club? And I think you saw that. I mean, maybe it's a different, slightly different case in terms of his personality, but I also felt that with Eden Hazard, that I think Hazard's not a player who's sort of particularly driven in the way that other players are driven, which is fine. I mean, if that's who he is, that's who he is. And I sort of think he was happy at Chelsea. He was comfortable at Chelsea. Obviously liked life in London. And there was this sort of constant demand. Oh, he's got to go to a really big club. And he does. And okay, he's a bit unlucky that he gets injured. And he hadn't really had a long-term injury before that. But he's sort of almost forgotten about now. He's just another one of those players who went to Real Madrid and it didn't work. And maybe players... I don't know, because it's easy to criticise players for not showing ambition, but sometimes maybe you've just got to accept that this is good. I'm enjoying this. I'm happy. Do I need to go bigger?
Yeah. Do you think Grealish is regretting his move at this point? I mean, you know, I know it's a kind of a well-worn thing at this stage, and I would say you will probably say, look, it's too soon to say with Grealish how things are going to go at Man City. Obviously, Pep Guardiola takes a bit of getting used to it and so on. It hasn't gone well, though.
No, it hasn't. It hasn't. I mean, he started the first 7 games of the season, I think, and there were little flickers in that. I mean, I was at that game when they lost to Tottenham on the opening day, and he looked completely lost in that game. But yeah, you'd say similar. I think Sterling's first season didn't go great. Mahrez certainly didn't go particularly well. It can take time for those of us. And I think there's a very basic thing that it's not just that he's no longer the biggest fish. He's got to learn to fit in with everybody else. And I think certainly there were signs early in the season that he was a little bit tentative. That whereas previously he'd taken on the defender, he sort of felt the need to sort of check back and
absolutely
keep possession.
And like he's really second guessing himself because like it's like everything that sort of comes naturally to him to do, Pep Guardiola's like wagging his finger like, no, don't do that, you know.
Yeah.
Stop, take your ego out of this, you know, you're part of a team now and blah, blah, blah. And he just seems that kind of like, oh no, I don't want to do what I can't do what I feel like I want to do.
Yeah, he's lost faith in what he used to come instinctively. And I think the other thing that's difficult for him is, you know, the way Grealish played at Villa was he'd play on the left and drift in, and he always had Matt Target going outside him, which just draws the fullback out slightly, just creates that space, and he can cut in onto his right foot. Well, that's not how it works, you see, because Cancelo goes inside, not outside. So suddenly Grealish then becomes the decoy. And, you know, if you look at their touches in the final third, Cancelo's 35 touches per 90 in the final third, Grealish is 38. So yeah, it's pretty much the same. The Cancelo is essentially as attacking as Grealish. And I it doesn't really matter who you are. I think that must take a lot of getting used to. It's a totally different style of football. Even just in that component, never mind all the other stuff about having to remember what position to take up, having to remember where you have to be to stop the opposition countering, you know, not being able just to kind of take the ball yourself because you're not actually obviously the best player anymore. You might have Phil Foden inside you, you might have Raheem Sterling inside you, you might have Bernardo Silva inside you, who are, you know, just as capable of doing something with the ball. And there's so much pressure to maintain possession, not to lose it by taking on a man too many. So I think, you know, you've seen his sort of confidence in his natural game has gone. And that is part of the process of learning how to play for Guardiola. But he hasn't come out the other side yet. And I guess there is a danger he doesn't come out the other side.
Yeah, well, you know, at the same time, though, his dreams are a mere speck on the windshield of the juggernaut of Manchester City's unstoppable cruise towards a 4 title in 5 years, it looks like. I mean, the form that they're in at the moment is just, I mean, what they've scored in the last, it's 18 goals in the last 4 league games. And that's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, we had all that sort of excitement at sort of the third of the waypoint of the season of, oh, we could have a genuine 3-horse title race. Since when Chelsea have stopped being able to defend. Liverpool haven't really done much wrong, but...
They lost points against Tottenham and have had a postponement, which has now created a sort of a six-point gap, you know, though they've got
a game. I think we're starting to see that the squad is... it's smaller than City, essentially. And so, yeah, Tottenham played pretty well against Liverpool, but... To what extent was that down to the midfield Liverpool had out, which clearly was nothing like the midfield that they'd have liked to have out. So I think there was always that sense that, I mean, actually any of those three sides were capable of suddenly putting together a run of 10 or a dozen or even 15 wins in a row, and City were the most likely. And sure enough, City, I don't know, what is it, 9 wins in a row now for City?
Let me see. They lost to Leipzig, and since then,
yeah, but in the league,
they lost to Palace on the 30th of October, and since then, every match in the league has been a win. So
yeah,
it's a lot of wins. It's a real string. You put together a string of wins like that, and you start to move away, and
that does seem to be a modern title race. But yeah, that's how it works. I mean, even Chelsea under Conte had that. Was that 17 wins in a row suddenly, and
yeah, through the middle of the season. So
yeah,
it does create a slightly anticlimactic dynamic, just in terms of when it becomes clear by, you know, February that there's a team that's won the league. Although that hasn't happened yet. I mean, Liverpool, Jurgen Klopp's been complaining about fixture congestion, obviously. Tomorrow he is a beneficiary of that, in that Leicester are the team that Leicester have to turn up, having been pummeled by City. 2 days later, they've got to go and play Liverpool, who haven't had a game over Christmas. This is incredibly unfair.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I guess it's always happened. I mean, I've been doing a lot of research recently on the 60s, and it's kind of incredible to look at the end of those seasons. I mean, especially when Leeds were, Leeds would be kind of flying in the FA Cup, the league, and the European Cup, or the First Cup, and they'd suddenly hit the end of March, and they'd have to play sort of, a dozen games in 4 weeks.
Did they have more games, are we talking here about postponements or replays? Like, did they have more games postponed?
Yeah.
Because, like, is Elland Road, like, at altitude or something like that? I mean, did they have frozen pitches more often than, like, other teams? Was there some reason why they, because it is, maybe it's just that Leeds were kind of in all the competitions until the latter stages, and they just...
That's exactly it. They were in the competitions at the latter stages. I mean, I think it's 69-70 where it's properly stupid that they... I think they play the cup final on the Saturday, and then they've got the second leg of the European Cup semi-final against Celtic on the following Tuesday, having already played sort of 5 games in the previous fortnight. This has always happened, but I guess it's we've got used to it not happening, and it feels unfair now, particularly with this random factor of COVID, which seems to allow some teams to call games off and other teams not to. And nobody seems to be able to get a straight answer of what the parameters are that allow you to call the game off. And I think, Crystal Palace, Leeds,
Chelsea
have felt pretty let down by that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is an interesting situation where it's evidently not a clear, clear criteria, because everybody seems to think they have a case until the Premier League says you have to play, you can have 2 weeks off. It's complete nonsense.
It is a nonsense, because I mean, the fact that we can't get an explanation of what the rule is suggests it's just not clear. I mean, of course, you're also dependent on medical departments to be totally honest.
Yeah. Which is nonsense.
But I mean, that game when Leeds were beaten by Arsenal, what was to stop them saying, like, really sorry, but three of the lads have been in close contact, so we're going to have to not play this? I mean, how closely monitored is that?
Yeah.
And clearly they were disadvantaged by not having had a COVID case with all the other injuries they had.
Yeah. I would trust Marcelo Bielsa's Leeds not to break any rules that exist.
Of all the managers, I think he is the one with the most integrity, which weirdly seems to get him into more trouble than other managers.
I mean, a rule that doesn't exist, like, you're not allowed to spy on the other team's training grounds, nobody's ever thought to write down. He would break that rule. But if it's, although maybe, I don't know. But sorry, anyway, Leeds have taken as much damage as possible. Although their game is off, their next game is off. Manchester United are going to be playing tonight, as far as we know. I see Ralph Rangnick has added his voice to the chorus of German voices, clamoring for five substitutions in the current circumstances. Do your hackles rise as an Englishman to hear all these Germans demanding rational, positive change in English football?
I mean, the nationality obviously is neither here nor there, but just to make that clear.
But it is right. Just to make it clear again, those Germans are Ralf Rangnick, Thomas Tuchel, and Jurgen Klopp. All of us are saying, give us fünf substitutions, bitte.
Yeah, and they happen to be members of the Gross Fear, who have the biggest squads and so benefit most from that. So I see the logic in five subs. I think I would be opposed to that generally. I think in the current situation as an emergency measure, I think it's probably not the daftest thing. I mean, I think there's something actually generally going on with injuries. And I know these things are notoriously, I mean, they're sort of impossible to prove causation. But this season, even before, you know, this current wave of the pandemic, seemed to be a season more affected by injuries than others. The fact that Leeds, Leicester, have been absolutely hammered by injuries. Like Brighton, their injury list. I mean, they obviously had a load of players back yesterday, but before that, they'd had an entire defence out. Even the fact that West Ham, I mean, I know that it's not a huge number of injuries, but losing Ogbonna and Zuma and Cresswell has caused them real problems. So Southampton have had huge problems. I mean, when they went to Arsenal, they had to sign Caballero on loan, but they were without another sort of half dozen players. So I don't know if this is a cumulative effect of trying to squeeze essentially 3.5 seasons into 3 seasons. Obviously Liverpool suffered with injuries last season. And maybe there is a sort of a build-up of, if you force players to play too many games in too short a period of time over a spell of 2 or 3 years, maybe more of them do break down.
Okay, well, we are going to see hopefully some more games happening over the next few days, but there's something else to talk about here, Jonathan, which is that I received an early Christmas present this year in the form, well, actually not of a copy of your book, your new novel, I should say, Streltsov, but in the form of a PDF of said novel, the book having failed to arrive.
Some failure of our collective postal services.
I don't know what's going on. I don't know what's going on with the post. But you have written a novel about, it's called Streltsov. It's about, I guess, Edward Streltsov, the great Soviet player of the 1950s, really. Why has he always been a figure of fascination for you?
Well, I mean, I suppose I should explain briefly his story. So he comes through. He's sort of an Erling Haaland figure, that he's just bigger than everybody else and quicker and stronger and scores these ridiculous goals where he just barges through 6 players and lashes in the top corner.
He's a superman.
Yeah, but he's also very good looking. He develops very, very early. He scores a hat-trick in each of his first 2 appearances for the USSR. And
sorry, he scored a hat-trick on each of his first 2?
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. One against Sweden and one against India. So the one against India maybe is not such a big deal, but still, you know, I think he was 16, 17 when he did that, but yeah, very young. And he sort of becomes a bit of a celebrity. He's part of the squad that wins the Olympics in 56. He almost single-handedly wins the semi-final when they're down to 9 men because of injury. And then he's left out of the final because his strike partner was injured and Gavril Kecalan, the national coach, liked his front 2 to play together at club level. And so everybody assumes the 58 World Cup is going to be his great... Yeah, he's 19. It's going to be... that's going to be his stage when he really announces himself to the world in the way that Pelé subsequently does. But on the final day of training, before the World Cup at the training camp, they then go into Moscow to get their suits. He goes for a drink afterwards, ends up going to a party at a dasher that night. And the following morning, he's arrested and charged with rape. And he ends up serving 6 years in the gulag. Now, there's significant doubt as to whether he did it. So Garry Kasparov, among others, but he's the most famous of them, sort of has led this campaign to get him a posthumous pardon. And you see, he then comes out of the gulag is banned for a couple of years, comes back and wins the league twice, and is named Soviet Player of the Year, which is, you know, I mean, I don't want to say redemption, because if he's a rapist, I'm not really sure that is redemption, but it is an extraordinary comeback. It's certainly true that he had offended people within the Soviet government who felt he was too individualistic. I think his drinking had become a problem, that he began to neglect certain responsibilities. So Soviet Union, for instance, they had a playoff against Poland to qualify for the World Cup in 1958.
And he would have only been like 20, 21 years old at that stage.
He was 18.
In 1958?
Well, in 1958 he was 19, but the playoff was 1957, so he was 18 for the playoff. And he missed the train. The game was in Leipzig, this playoff. And he missed the train. They had to hold up the train. He got in a taxi and chased it. And so, you know, he'd sort of gone off the rails a bit. And so there's all this sort of, all these suggestions that maybe he was set up. Now, yeah, if you really press me, do I think he did it? Yeah, I do. Having gone through the KGB files. But what's certainly true is the investigation was not particularly well conducted. And there are certain elements of doubt, I guess. And obviously part of the problem is that forensics in those days, they could tell you, a blood group, but they couldn't give you DNA. So the woman he's alleged to have raped, Marina Lebedeva, she certainly had sex that night with somebody of the same blood group as him. Whether it's consensual, whether it's him, that's the question. So it struck me when I first heard that story, it's actually very like the incident in the Malabar Caves in Passage to India, to bring it back to David Lean rather neatly, with Dr. Aziz. And did he commit the rape? Did he not? It's this sort of great sort of mystery at the centre of it. And I think once you stop trying to solve it, once you sort of accept it's a mystery, then, you know, a lot of quite interesting things happen. So the story is told through the eyes of a functionary at the club. So it's partly about what is it to be a functionary at a club who has this figure you revere, and then the chaos when suddenly he's arrested. So there's, you know, the drama of the court case and everything, but also it's about perceptions of reality and how you know, can you ever actually know the truth?
Yeah. This question of the unknowability of things is a theme in the book.
Yeah, exactly.
You're writing, you grasp at the details, they slip away. This is what age does to you. What you think you know, it turns out you've constructed later, often from misremembered or misinterpreted details. Did you ever know to start with, or did you just read it? This is not simply an account of your work process doing Guardian pieces, but a more general comment on the difficulty of ever really nailing things down.
Yeah, the fact that there's a court case at the middle of it where, you know, in theory you do get to the truth in a court case, that seemed quite a nice metaphor for that idea. I mean this is going to sound terribly pretentious, but the older I get, the more I sort of think that most writing is actually about how no writing can ever be true.
So it's all fiction. This is not your first work of fiction. Ones have been fictional as well.
First conscious work of fiction, I guess. But you know, it's the unknowability of memory and the problems of memory and things you think you remember clearly, and then you check them and it turns out to be very different.
Well, congratulations on the book. Do you have any more novels, do you think, in the pipeline? Did you find it more interesting to write something which, you know, kind of imaginative in this way? Imaginative is a suggests that the previous books have not also been imagined.
Yeah, but it is different because you're very specific. You know, you're trying to internalize it, or you're trying to put yourself into the interior of somebody else. That you're trying to say, you know, how would this figure have regarded this? How would he have dealt with this? What, you know, what was his life like? And actually, one of the when I went through the editing process, which was a very, very fortunate, a friend of mine, a novelist, Richard Beard. He edited it for free just because he was bored. And a lot of his suggestions were taking out detail. You know, there's a tendency to sort of log detail. And you just need to be impressionistic. You don't have to kind of go into huge amounts of detail. And I think that's one of the differences between fiction and non-fiction. In non-fiction, you're on the outside trying to build up the story through each tiny little tile of data that you can find.
Mm.
Whereas fiction, you're on the inside just trying to express what that would have felt like to him at the time.
Yeah. And have you attempted to use this form maybe on forthcoming stuff? I mean, I know that you're doing a book about Jack Charlton. Is it about the Charlton brothers?
The Charlton brothers, yeah.
So, you know, what about doing this one as a novel?
Well, I was commissioned as a non-fiction book, so I'm not sure my editor would go with that. No, look, it was good to do it because it's a different discipline. It just sort of, it's just fun to change things sometimes. But they are different. They are different, and I think just on a very practical level, as David Peace found, writing fiction about people who are still alive.
Mm.
It's pretty awkward and tricky and difficult. I think there's plenty of stuff with Jack Charlton, and Bobby, of other people's memories of them. I mean, memory, of course, with the two of them becomes a massive issue as well, doesn't it? Mm. So am I tempted to do other novels? Yeah, I wouldn't mind. I'll see how this one goes. I mean,
if you could bring them out, same sort of, each one has a footballer surname title. You could be like Luca Caoli for New Statesman Raiders.
Well, there's a couple of ideas I think would work. I think this was of the ideas I've got, this is definitely the most pared back, the slimmest volume. But we'll see how it goes. I mean, if it sells, great. I mean, it was the Observer's list of novels to read in 2022. It was on that yesterday, which is very kind of them.
Very kind.
Didn't have to do that. So. Yeah, and the source of the problem, it's essentially self-published. You know, I published it through Blizzard.
Yeah.
So it's not in any bookshops, but you can order it from a Blizzard website. And you can order it on Amazon as well, but I get more money if you go through the Blizzard website, so please do that. And don't take Ken's postal problems as being indicative of our general level of service.
No, they're getting out there somehow. I see people with photographs of them on social media. I'm not one of those people, but maybe one day. Jonathan Wilson. Been a pleasure as always talking to you this Christmas.
Cheers, happy Christmas.
Ronaldo, when I met Ronaldo, it was just a dream come true, and he said to me, are you okay? Because I was crying. Happy tears.
Kids. That's not for me.
Kids.
The girl who got Ronaldo's shirt was on the Late Late Show.
Christmas is for kids.
Which, by the way, I don't agree with.
It's so annoying though. These kids, why do they need to be on the pitch? The pitch is for the players, the team, and the supporters.
This time of year we all turn into. Come on. Children who invade the pitch are being invited onto the Late Late Show and showered with gifts. Nah, not for me.
It's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine, it's not that at all. It's the opposite of that, it's to persuade the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.